Good morning. Los Angeles has more homeless veterans than any other community. That's according to Housing for Good. The project helped push the number of housed homeless veterans past the 50% mark. We'll talk with the woman who launched the initiative, Christine Margiotta. Seattle is also moving the needle on homelessness. We'll talk with the Seattle-based regional coordinator for the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, Katie Miller. And we'll see what Maui Mayor Alan Arakawa has to say about what we've heard so far this week as our series on homelessness from the outside in continues. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
I'm Chris Vandercook. For the artist on the edge, just getting around and keeping in touch are a struggle. Dance instructor Nikki Guest tells us how she hangs on to her determination to pursue her art.
It's Wednesday, September 16th. The conversation starts now. First, this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Trying to imagine the extent of homelessness in a city the size of L.A.
Well, that's more than just what other people imagine if they are in the greater L.A. area.
Yeah.
And we're going to see what lessons L.A. might have for Hawaii.
Good.
Now, in a city of 10 million, yeah, you might expect a lot of homeless people. According to the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, it has a little more than 44,000 homeless people. That's up over the 39,000 in 2013. And if you think Kaka'ako is full of tents in Los Angeles, tents, makeshift shelters, and vehicles as shelters were up 85% from just 2 years ago. Those statistics and the rest of what came out of the point-in-time count can be daunting, but there are bright spots, too. Since 2011, L.A. has had a 38% decrease in veteran homelessness, according to Home for Good. That's the region's initiative to end homelessness. Christine Margiotta is the Vice President of Community Impact at United Way of Greater Los Angeles. And in 2010, she launched Home for Good. Christine Margiotta is on the phone with us now from her L.A. office. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
In January, L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti announced that there was a major milestone. L.A. was better than halfway toward ending veteran homelessness by the end of this year. And the Home for Good initiative played a leading role in securing the funds to house those roughly 3,400 veterans. He also said that for the remaining half of the veterans, that there would be an additional 1,300 places for veterans or even chronically homeless people who would be housed from HUD funding and an appropriation from LA's Housing Authority. Your LA example right there, and from what we've heard from other communities this week, seems to say that aligned efforts of public and private partnerships and all the levels of government seems to be the categorical recipe for low-income rentals that would end homelessness at its root. Is it?
That's been one of the greatest successes of the work here in Los Angeles, is really seeing the public and private sector, along with the nonprofit community, really come together around solutions. So that's both looking together at what works, what kinds of programs and best practices can we implement here in Los Angeles, and how do we invest in those programs holistically across public and private funders.
We hear a lot about best practices, and that just sort of becomes a term that people hear, but don't necessarily know what they mean. In terms of best practices, looking at the situation in Los Angeles and in Hawaii, what do you enumerate as those best practices?
So one of them is most simply what you just mentioned, which is coming together across the community to build the public and political will to solve the problem, to really talk about ending homelessness versus managing it or reducing it. So that was one of the first things that we realized was critical as we were launching Home for Good here in Los Angeles, was to bring together government, philanthropy, the nonprofit community, the business community, and our elected leadership around key permanent solutions to homelessness. And that's really the other major piece of this for us, is looking at how do we permanently solve this problem in our community. And what we saw time and time again, both here in LA and across the country, was permanent housing with supportive services as the key solution to homelessness. So whether that be long-term rental supports in housing with mental health care, health services, substance abuse treatment in housing, or affordable housing for those who are newly homeless and just need more affordable rent to get back on their feet. But across the board, the theme was that permanent housing works to end homelessness, that that is truly the only thing that creates a sustainable end to this problem.
Is LA using the Housing First model?
We are. And that was, you know, in years past had been quite controversial and I think misunderstood across the community. So very simply stated, Housing First is ensuring that someone has rapid access to a permanent place to live, that that is truly your first priority as you encounter someone out on the streets, is securing a permanent home for them and then wrapping around the supportive services that they need to stay there. So again, that health care, job training and placement, mental health services if they need it, but that housing is the first and most critical intervention.
When we have talked with Dr. Sam Samberis, who developed Housing First in other communities around the country, they all come out and say things like, well, you know, housing people is a lot cheaper than managing them. You alluded to that a moment ago. In LA's case, how much cheaper was it?
We conducted a study back in 2009. United Way conducted a study, and the Economic Roundtable also conducted a study of 10,000 people across our community. And what they found in both studies was that it was over 40% cheaper to place someone in permanent housing than to leave them on our streets. And that's because when they're out on the streets, they're cycling in and out of emergency rooms, jails, and other costly crisis systems. And they're doing just that. They're cycling through them without ever resolving the root of their problem, which is the lack of a place to live.
And then when you add on top of that the cost to do sweeps and police enforcement and all the rest of it, then that can be even more than what you've just cited. Would that be true?
Exactly. Yes. So that's precisely managing the problem in a very temporary way, because we know when we do sweeps or when someone uses the emergency room for a couple nights or they're hospitalized, we know they're right back on the streets a few days later, because once that crisis is resolved, they still don't have a place to live, a permanent home.
Christine Margiotta, if Housing First is the answer, if it saves that kind of taxpayer money, you're talking about 40% cheaper to be able to house people than manage them, why does there seem to be so much pushback to build more shelters and to focus on these temporary solutions that you say don't work?
Well, I think it's, you know, as you look at the problem, you walk down the street, I know this is similar in Hawaii as it is here in Los Angeles, you see hundreds and thousands of people out on the streets, and I think it's our human nature to want a quick solution. You want to see the problem solved quickly. And because permanent housing isn't always the most visible solution, or it doesn't feel to be as quick a solution, I think people jump to these more, short-term fixes like shelters, which certainly have a role to play in Housing First, but they must be connected to permanent housing. So I think it's understandable that people sometimes jump to the short-term fix, but what we see, what the data tell us again and again, is that the only solution that's truly sustainable is that link to a permanent place to live. We know here in LA, it's 85 to 90% of people placed in permanent housing through a Housing First model stay in that permanent housing. They're not cycling back to the streets, versus what we've seen in temporary shelters is that even those who go through a shelter program and are placed in housing, only about 50% of them are successful, and that's a national statistic. So, you know, both for its cost effectiveness and the fact that it just works in solving the problem, that's why we as a community have really embraced that Housing First and permanent housing model.
And thanks very much for sharing that with us this morning and for giving us your time.
Thank you.
Christine Margiotta is the Vice President of Community Impact at United Way of Greater Los Angeles. 5 years ago, she launched Home for Good, the region's initiative to end homelessness. Home for Good brought together over 200 partners, public and private funders, to leverage over $700 million in resources to house over 20,000 people to date.
I had a wife, I had a job, I had a life of my own. Now I spend my days and nights on the streets all alone. There are many like me, oh, it's sad to see. The world is ours, such as I.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:14. Coming up, why an employed dance teacher can't find a home. First, the backyard quiz.
O Mau, o Kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're remembering the classic story of an immigrant who came to America, made a fortune, and used his wealth for the benefit of local communities, including Hawaii's homeless population. The foundation that's named after this philanthropist and his wife has been a leader in the construction of facilities for Hawaii's homeless population for decades and has helped thousands of people over the years. Their efforts in Hawaii have been called a charitable empire, and their name can be found on buildings that include the Helping Hand Center for Human Services, Castle Medical Center. Their fortune was made in transportation and real estate. At one time, the head of the family was Hawaii's largest individual landowner. This morning, we're looking for the name of the wealthy power couple that made a lasting contribution to Hawaii, and we'll be back with it in a half hour. Call 941-3689. Are 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Moonlight slipping on a midnight lake. Homeless, homeless. The moonlight slipping on a midnight lake.
And we are homeless,
we are homeless. The moonlight slipping on a midnight lake.
And we are
homeless,
homeless,
homeless.
Boom, boom.
The moonlight slipping on a midnight lake.
Good morning. I'm Vivian Lee from the Hawaii State Foundation on Culture and the Arts. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR 2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Performing artists need to be able to get around. Most of the time, the work is intermittent and you have to pursue it. Nikki Guess is a dancer and dance instructor who lives in a tent, using what funds she has to eat, get around by bus, and maintain a mobile phone. She's got a determination to pursue her art that cuts through her day-to-day struggles. We spoke with her the other day as she rode a bus to one of her classes.
I'm mostly known as a dancer. I've been dancing since I was a kid. I've been teaching dance for over 20-something years. I teach people of all ages and abilities. I've done a lot of teaching dance with individuals with disabilities. I do hip-hop. I do dance movement. I've done musical theater dance classes with individuals with disabilities, mainly the theater, the musical theater classes.
Nikki, is it difficult for you to get access to the kind of opportunities that you need to be pursuing creatively?
I think more so in confidence it is. And to some extent, and then in another way, it's actually been very helpful. You know, being, I guess, in my situation and the way I live, it's a little bit, I don't feel kind of at the level and status of being able to do things that other people do. Right now, I mean, I've got a budget in, unfortunately, sometimes your costumes and outfits cost money. traveling, you know, I had a hard time getting to rehearsal, and I barely scraped up the $250 for the bus because I didn't have a bus pass at the time.
Well, that's what I was thinking about, Nikki, just the whole idea of being able to get around to create opportunities for yourself, yeah?
It's fortunately, I need a bus pass for my work. So it's something that I budget in. I do sometimes I get stuck. There's like a month where I'm trying to between walking, riding my bike, and scraping up money for the bus. The last month was, I think the last 2 weeks of the month, I was actually fortunate. Someone came across an extra bus pass and offered it to me. And so it helped me out tremendously for the rest of the month. The beginning was really, really tough, and it's pretty tough, you know, to keep a cell phone on, to travel, just to have your basic toiletries, necessities, to wash your clothes. I mean,
well,
a lot of those is luxury.
You have to set priorities about the things you can spend your limited funds on, right? And I would think that you wouldn't be able to mount much in terms of productions and create creative opportunities when you're still worrying about what to eat. How
you
to
know, like, well, yeah. So sometimes, you know, I sacrifice a little bit of the eating to do what I really want. At this point, I try to do whatever I can because I'm in a stage where I just feel like I want to do the things that make me happy. I want to be happy, you know, even if I have nothing and I'm on the street, I want to be happy.
Are you
yes.
pretty good at doing that, Nikki? I mean, calls for a
I
lot.
Mean, I pretty much, I mean, I'm struggling financially, but I'm running my own business. It's kind of still in works. I kind of messed up not turning in my invoices and now all my bank money. But, I mean, to be able to just teach dance, even as I'm struggling, I mean, those things, it helps me get through my days mentally. When I work in a so-called regular job and a 9-to-5 and I'm not making enough to survive and it's not doing something that I don't love, it's a lot more stressful trying to, you know, figure out. On the weekend, I had nothing. Labor Day, everything's closed, no work. Those moments are really hard, and I realize how, to me, pathetic or miserable my life is. But then today, I get to go to work. I'm teaching 2 dance classes, and all of that disappears, and I get to be happy and just enjoy life in that moment and stuff. And
Nikki,
for that moment, I'm not that homeless person, you know?
Well, Nikki, that takes some internal discipline to be able to just savor those moments and not think about your condition, doesn't it?
I've come a long way on that. I have a daughter, and when I was raising her, we struggled. There was moments we didn't have a place and we were homeless. And I think during that time, especially because I was a mother, it was really, really mentally tough on me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, tough to the point that I even made an attempt myself to go and walk in to sign up to see if I can get some counseling just so I can mentally get through it and that I wouldn't crash. Unfortunately, I have developed some kind of coping skills that most often they're like, oh, you're all good. You don't need anything. Because I just keep functioning, because I've been raised to just keep moving forward, keep functioning. Even when I'm feeling at my lowest, it's like this feeling that I'm not allowed to. I have to keep moving forward. I have to keep functioning. And I have to be there for others. So,
I think being there for others, Nikki, is a big part of what helps a lot of people get out of bed in the morning, even if they have a bed.
I mean, at this point, even through being homeless, one thing I've always done is volunteer work. I run one of the sites of one of the programs for one of the nonprofits, and it's a once-a-month program. But that was a really big, tremendous opportunity for me. And, being in my situation and being looked upon as me, Nikki, the person that does these things, not Nikki, the homeless person, and to be able to be trusted and ask for my skills to be able to do that has just been really tremendously uplifting for me.
Nikki Guess is a dancer and dance instructor, and you can learn more about her on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Back when Watergate cleared the deck for Democrats.
Richard Nixon had resigned, and Democrats were sensing that they could really be in power once again.
17 Democrats sensed they could win the White House in 1976. The one who made it surprised everyone. Lessons for the GOP 16. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
We know homelessness is tough. Life on the street, life in a car, maybe a place in a shelter. But as a recently settled case with Hawaii's largest shelter also shows, homelessness can be even more difficult for someone who is disabled. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
This is a heartbreaking story of a woman who, for all intent and purposes, years ago, would never have appeared that she would become homeless. But to be homeless and disabled caused her a great deal of consternation, and certainly did for IHS too, after all this lawsuit.
I'll try and summarize Anita Hofschneider's story, but I encourage listeners to go and read it. It's a terrific read and a cautionary tale. It's about a woman named Ingrid Rodrigues, and she, a couple of years ago at age 59, after 3 decades of employment, she got laid off from her job. She couldn't find another job. Her savings were running out. So in 2012, she called IHS, the Institute for Human Services. But they wouldn't accept her unless she was able to pass an admissions test. What you have to be able to demonstrate is that you can get on the floor and then lift yourself back up again without assistance. They call it the mattress test. The problem for Ingrid Rodrigues is she suffers from severe arthritis and vertigo and other problems, and there was just no way that she could possibly pass this test, even though she very much needed shelter.
Now, Connie Mitchell, the director of IHS, says that the shelter used to have an informal policy to test people like this, but that they don't do it anymore.
Right, but Anita checked with the Legal Aid Society worker, also found out that, you know, there's a gray area as to whether this actually happens or not. What we can tell you for sure is that IHS agreed to settle a lawsuit that was brought forward with the help of the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission. And under that settlement, they are going to amend their policy regarding this and have some staff training. Now, in the case of Ingrid Rodrigues, she did finally get some justice there, but it took quite a while for this to happen. The bottom line is, you cannot violate the Federal Fair Housing Act, because that way you would be discriminating against the disabled. And that was the core of this lawsuit. Very important to understand that nearly one quarter of homeless people have permanent physical disabilities, and the discrimination cases arising out of those situations are very much on the rise, as this case illustrates.
Well, if a quarter of the homeless population is also disabled, wouldn't shelters have come into contact with this situation before? I mean, it is not a new.
Yeah, it is not a new situation. They say that there are staffing limitations, there are cost concerns. Imagine having to help someone get up in the middle of the night to use the restroom, for example. I mean, you can see how this could be a dramatic problem. The good news I'm able to share with you is not only the settlement, but Ingrid Rodriguez did finally get some housing. She's in a senior housing complex in Wahiwa. She's now 63, but she is still traumatized by the whole experience and hopes that maybe some good will come out of it for others. Another side to the homeless situation that you don't think about very much, that a lot of these folks, it's beyond their control, the disabilities that they suffer.
Really, this isn't the vision of homeless people that we usually see, someone who is also disabled, but maybe we need to understand that if you say there are 25% of them who are, then we need to broaden our vision a bit. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii, honored to be named one of America's best banks by Forbes for 6 consecutive years. Learn more at boh.com/bestbank. Member FDIC.
Last year, Seattle's King County listed 1,021 chronically homeless people. As of this year, the county shows 815. According to Hawaii's latest point-in-time count, 1,372 people are chronically homeless statewide. Those 2015 numbers don't yet appear on the official HUD annual report to Congress. That report isn't out yet, but Katie Miller is watching. She has worked on the homeless issues in her home city of Seattle for 20 years, and more recently, she is the regional coordinator for the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness in 12 states, including Hawaii. It's a lot of territory with some similar responses to homelessness that are both challenging and working. Katie Miller joins us now from her office in Seattle. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for making time for us. Although many of the cities have released their 2015 numbers already, we just mentioned that the annual HUD report to Congress, which details all that and quantifies all that, is due to come out later on this fall. But in the 2014 report, though, Hawaii is among the top 5 states with unsheltered homeless people. The other 4 are California, Nevada, Montana, and Georgia. But some of those states have communities like L.A., which we talked with earlier today, which are making great strides in ending veteran and chronic homelessness. What have you seen has been the key factors in those communities doing well?
You know, I would say that it really is about being very strategic about investments and focusing efforts on those practices that we know nationally work, including Housing First and increasing permanent supportive housing and targeting those resources to those that are most in need. And LA is doing an incredible job of that on a number of different fronts where they're really coordinating their funding efforts and then creating a pipeline of units and resources for people, again, that are most vulnerable and helping those that are living outside move to permanent housing quickly.
You were recently in Hawaii. Obviously, your home city is Seattle, where you've been working on homelessness for the last 2 decades. But based on what you've observed in the communities across your region, including Seattle, how similar or unique is Hawaii to the way that our state is grappling with homelessness to the ways that those other states are trying to approach it?
Sure. You know, I enjoyed my visit in Hawaii. I was struck by the great work that people are doing there. There's some really important conversations that are happening right now. But I'm aware that the problems aren't very different than what we're seeing in other big cities on the West Coast. And I think folks in Hawaii are struggling with that and thinking about ways to deal with a very expensive rental market, but I would say that is also happening on the West Coast. And so these challenges are mirrored in Hawaii, where you have very low vacancy rates and high rental market, and the rents just continue to grow and get higher. And so I would say that there's some great practices that are being done in Seattle and Portland, Oregon, and San Francisco and L.A. that could be great models for Hawaii to help to move people into that rental market quickly.
How do you see the attraction to strategic investment happening in Hawaii after what you've seen in other cities and other communities statewide, nationwide, in terms of drawing together some of those unusual suspects that Beth Sander from Community Solutions talked about yesterday, looking kind of a little further afield and trying to create a compelling reason financially for a lot of people, but mission-driven for others, to be able to make that strategic investment that seems to be so crucial?
You know, I really encourage Hawaii to really bring all of the resources to the table that they can. I think that there are some tools that are not being utilized at this point or at the same table. When communities can bring all of their funding resources, the federal, the state, the local, the philanthropic resources, be on the same plan, game plan, and move towards the same goals, we see great impact. And an example of that is in L.A., where they use the public and private partnerships to really drive towards the development of permanent supportive housing and resources that are moving people off the streets into permanent housing. And I hope that Hawaii will work to strategically invest, again, that state, federal, and local resources working together to make a greater impact.
What else do you see not being used or not being used as well?
You know, I think that it's important, again, when I bring up the concept of tools, there are a lot of resources in Hawaii and a lot of tools, and it's very important that they leverage one another. And so all of those mainstream resources, such as mainstream housing, employment, healthcare, Medicaid resources, TANF resources, all of those mainstream resources can leverage other resources and maximize the dollars that you have to invest in people's into housing and supporting people in housing. And so it's important that any local dollar spent, any state dollar spent, federal dollars are looking at the whole toolkit to think about what can be matched, what can be paired, and then bundled to help, again, make a greater impact and create more opportunities.
How does that leverage really happen, though? I mean, we hear those terms. We talked about that a little earlier when Christine Maggiato was here talking to us about what was going on in L.A., saying that they leveraged $700 million. How do you really leverage?
It's really important that those key players are at the same table. Those conversations need to be happening together, and that planning and that work needs to be intentional. It's really important that the investment, the housing development arm at the state is at the same table with the housing authority and the mainstream workforce system. All of those players need to be at the same table and talking about how they can come together and make an impact as a team. And to see each other as part of the puzzle that helps to move the system forward.
When you were here last month, you met with the governor's leadership team on homelessness. Did you give them this message?
We did, and we talked about this. And I know that the State Interagency Council on Homelessness will be reconvening under the guidance of Scott Morishige, and I'm excited about that. And I hope that when that group gets back together, again, they think about the impact that they can make as a group. And it's very important to see how they fit into that complex puzzle and can really work to create innovation together.
Is there an unusual suspect that you see isn't at that table that you would say there's really somebody missing here and this is who it is?
You know, I think that we are learning more and more every day, and some of the opportunities that may be available that we haven't tapped into yet in Hawaii is Medicaid and thinking about how Medicaid can help and support the system, again, to provide those services and permanent housing to support people with intensive needs. So really making sure that the healthcare system, the Medicaid system is at the table, making sure, again, that the workforce system, the housing authority is at the table, and HHS through the TANF system supporting families and looking at those opportunities. So again, I think it will just be very important that it's very intentional who's at the table and who has the authority to make decisions. And then I also encourage the faith community to be brought to the table, as well as the incredible service providers that you have on the ground. So again, you have a great team of players, and they all need to be at the same table. They're working very hard, and it's important that everyone's on the right and same path.
Aside from Los Angeles, aside from a few of the other communities that you've just mentioned, is there anyone that you think that Hawaii especially should be looking toward as a model of using those best practices that you talked about and some of the best policies that Hawaii might implement?
Sure. You know, there's some great examples across the country. Again, communities working with different populations and doing different, very innovative things. But again, I would say look at Houston, look at Salt Lake City, Utah, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, all working towards a housing first model, which really is about working with urgency to get people into permanent housing quickly. So reducing the barriers and understanding that, you know, it's not about having people ready for housing. It's about providing housing and providing the support services quickly to have someone stable and rebuild their lives and recover quickly and move on and be able to contribute in the community. And I think that is a very important model. And again, you'll see it in other parts of the country where the entire community has changed their mindset and are moving towards a recovery, helping people quickly get off the street, which can be so damaging in their lives the longer they spend outside.
Katie Miller, you mentioned working with urgency. That's exactly what we have to do, so we have to say goodbye to you for the moment. But thank you very much for speaking with us this morning.
Thank you so much for your time.
Katie Miller is a regional coordinator on the National Initiatives Team at the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Supply, announcing Radiance Reflective Roof Shingles, solar reflective shingles designed and made for Hawaii to reflect the heat and help keep homes cool. Learn more at radianceroof.com.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. I've got Bert on the line, and it looks as if there's some tech initiatives that could bring opportunity to Hawaii.
Well, you know, we've been always wanting to get the director from DBID from, you know, even the last administration, but the current administration's director, he's really into it, Louis Salaverria, and he's going to be on the show. We're going to talk to him about all the stuff that's going on over at DBID and how it perhaps will impact us from an economic standpoint. You know, we'll talk everything from, you know, there's this cool conference coming up called Future Focus. There's a new curriculum that Pixar is coming out with that's going into the DOE. There's talk about broadband. We'll talk about, you know, the tech initiatives. I mean, it'll be a pretty good discussion tonight, so I would hope everybody to tune in.
I hope they do too, Bert. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
As you probably know better than most, homelessness on your island looks different from homelessness in other places and from other islands. As part of our series on homelessness from the outside in, for responses from each mayor to the ideas that we're hearing this week. Today, Maui Mayor Alan Arakawa joins us. Good morning, Mayor. Thank you for the time.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thank you for the call.
Good to be able to speak with you a bit. Now, as we've seen over this last couple of days, most of the focus of, and I shouldn't say over the last couple of days, but over such a long period of time, a lot of focus on homelessness has been Kaka'ako-centered or on Oahu. But how would you characterize Maui homelessness compared to what we see and hear over on Oahu and on other islands?
Well, we're handling a little bit better than Oahu, but the real challenge comes in that we have very, very little support from the Department of Health in the mental health and drug abuse areas. And because of the lack of support, we're seeing more and more people in the homeless category. The other real aspect that's affecting everyone is the price of affordable housing. So normal working families are having a very, very difficult time even finding rentals because the prices are either too high or they're non-existent. So we're literally creating a new category of homeless people who are really diligently trying to make a living and can't afford the prices here.
We just talked with Katie Miller, the regional coordinator for the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, and she said that, you know, we need to be working with urgency. From what you've just said, it doesn't feel like there is as much urgency being put toward the issue of creating affordable rentals as Maui and the state needs. Is there a way that you see that Hawaii should be bringing together some of the unusual suspects, as Beth Sander from Community Solutions mentioned yesterday, that might change the game?
Well, the unusual suspects are our county councils and our legislators to a large degree, passing rules that require huge amounts of money to be put in for the permitting process and limiting the development of affordable houses. Because of all the red tape that's been there, we are literally creating a hell for people who want to be able to get into workforce housing. Now, look at the prices of the median price of housing on Oahu is at $700,000. How many people do you know working in your occupation or in many, many occupations that earn that kind of money? You know, making the mortgages are becoming more and more difficult, and finding affordable rentals is becoming more and more difficult because of the cost of the properties and the building of the and construction of the houses.
Both of our guests today, Christine Margiotta from the from LA's Home for Good project of United Way there, and also Katie Miller, were talking about Housing First being cheaper than managing homeless people, but that there really has to be a change of mindset. How do you see that change of mindset happening on Maui?
Well, the change of mindset has to come in several different layers. Again, the State Department of Health has to provide the core infrastructure that we need to be able to have long-term care for those that have mental and chemical dependency problems. A lot of these people, once they become homeless, there's no hope for them because it's a downward spiral. And there's no way for them to physically or mentally be able to work their way out of these challenges. Now, that being said, we do have a lot of agencies that have been taking care of our homeless for a number of decades now, but they're being overwhelmed. The sheer numbers that are coming up are showing that there's not enough support for the infrastructure that's already there. So, as a matter of fact, this afternoon we'll be holding a press conference and we'll be unveiling our proposal to deal with the homeless situation, but it's in four different levels. It's not a one-size-fits-all solution. Depending on what group you're talking about, you know, there are those that are out in the street that are they're absolutely homeless. Here, if you take a look at the point-in-time counts, we're about 600, and we can try and create temporary housing for those. If you look at the other numbers, those that have houses, there are another 600. We're having a real difficult time with our Section 8 housing, our federal grants, because there's just no place for them to rent. And we're liable to lose a lot of that Section 8 money because we have no place to spend it. And if those people that want to rent, finding something that fits within the categories that the feds are looking at is almost non-existent. So it's an escalating problem, and it's becoming much, much worse because of the lack of inventory.
Which seems to be the same issue that we talk about island to island, but looking a little bit different based upon the populations that you're talking about. Still, it comes down to how are you going to attract people who will be willing to be mission driven in that way to create that kind of housing or to accept a housing voucher for someone who is a homeless veteran or for another homeless person. How do you do something a little bit differently that might attract someone who would be, to change it up a little bit?
Again, it's multi-pronged. First, we do have to create some place for them to go. People, whether they're homeless or not, are people, and they have to be cared for as people. So we're looking at creating campsites in various communities that we have homeless situations with. And along with those campsites, we want to be able to get most of our nonprofit agencies to handle the people at the campsites, not have to go hunting through all the brush and the behind buildings and looking for them. We actually want to be able to try and have most of the homeless go to certain specified areas.
Now you're talking about being able to create something in that gap time, but if the the emphasis is on trying to move them to permanent housing, that seems to be a different issue altogether.
Permanent housing in and of itself will not work. People with mental challenges and chemical dependency problems, even if you give them a house right now, they won't be able to maintain or stay there. They don't understand what is necessary to be able to upkeep it.
So housing first is not on your agenda?
The permanent housing is a secondary challenge that we have to be able to meet with, because unless you have the support from the Department of Health to be able to have the people that can deal with those mental challenges and chemical dependency problems, it's almost fruitless. All of the agencies that we have are having problems because we don't have the support that we need from the Department of Health. This situation didn't occur overnight. This is from decades of neglect at the Department of Health. They just haven't been doing their job.
All right, Mayor, we know that you have to go to your next appointment, and we thank you for being able to squeeze us in.
Thank you very much, and this will be a continued conversation. Because it's a very critical issue, so thank you for taking it up.
And we will again. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
Alan Arakawa is the mayor of Maui County.
1,000 homeless people on the street before. I even took them food. I tried to give them more. I sat down to hear some stories. It made me wonder why this misfortune that he spoke of made a grown man cry. And I ain't trying to make myself look like a saint, because I ain't. We could all do better painting with the paint. Painting all these painful pictures, planting stigmas full of hate. This man is still a man, still trying to pull his weight. With a couple grubby hands, reaching for a couple nickels. These grubby hands built and launched 100 warlike missiles. And told 1,000 riddles in the middle of a war with himself for his health. And now he's stuck here in a pickle. He's in between the bases of his sanity and not. Home is not a place, the world has left him out to rot. We living in prosperity, but what if that all stopped? Like you were reaching out and everybody.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought of a philanthropist who made it his mission to help Hawaii's homeless population and whose foundation has grown to become one of the nation's largest charitable trusts. His story followed the classic Horatio Alger pattern. He was one of seven children, born to a family from Austria-Hungary with only a sixth-grade education. He became Hawaii's largest individual landowner and a generous contributor to charities that help people put poverty and homelessness behind them. He and his wife established a foundation based on a famous line from the Talmud. If all the afflictions of the world were assembled on one side of the scale and poverty on the other, poverty would outweigh them all. The work of the Harry and Jeanette Weinberg Foundation continues today in Hawaii and around the country, and that's our quiz for today.
And we had a winner. Brian Connolly knew that answer and will be getting the T-shirt. Thanks very much for calling us. And if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, a literacy program used by Hawaii students in grades 2 through 12, offering Home Edition, an online tool to help parents engage in the learning process. Achieve3000.com/HawaiiParents.
That's going to do it for day three of our look at homelessness from the outside in. Up tomorrow, we're going to get a national look from the Alliance to End Homelessness. Also, we're going to take a look at Oregon.
And we're going to talk about coexisting with the downtown Honolulu homeless community at Kumu Kahua Theater.
Meanwhile, as we've been having conversation this morning, we've also had something else happening around these parts. We have a special early bird campaign running today, tomorrow, and Friday. And there are some special incentives for those who call. And we'd like to thank some of the folks who've been calling this morning. Margaret Friedman and Emma Matsunaga and Jane Lovell called in to make a pledge of support, early bird support, to Hawaii Public Radio. You can join them. You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689.
It's been nice to see some bustle around the station this morning as we get
It has been, as we all know, that we're not that far away from a pledge drive, and every dollar earned now to continue radio discussions like we've been able to have this week and others, that comes from a lot of our listeners. Over 62% of our operating budget comes from people just like you. And we thank you so much.
And we've been hearing them on the phone, hearing those phones ring. It's great sound.
We've had 139 early bird pledges, and we're looking forward to hearing many new more pledges come in, including we have three new members. That's always a nice thing, too. So thank you very much. Welcome, and welcome to the conversation. Now, if you would like to talk to us, you can do that via our talkback line. That number is a little different. It's 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook if you like, at Hawaii Conversation, and we'll respond. Or you can tweet us at HI Conversation, or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive. Links to more information about guests and topics are there, too. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll look forward to seeing you back here tomorrow morning as we have another look at homelessness in Hawaii from the outside in. We'll be here with you tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock for more of The Conversation. See you then.